Christmas is a special time of year where we need to find that one thing, that one perfect gift to give someone. But what if you were giving them five slightly less perfect gifts as you go along? Hi, everyone. Welcome to our top five games of the year.
Okay, that's actually really good.
just a quick disclaimer before we start this video. This isn't top five games that came out in 2020. This is just top five games that we played in 2020.
Yeah. Hi, everyone. Emilio here on a Bite Marks top five list? Question mark? You know
what?
I expect the thumbnail to be riddled with red question marks and a photo of a guy just pointing to like a cheeseburger for no reason. We wanted to do something.
Fucking better watch out.
We wanted
Ultra, we're coming for you.
We wanted to do something special. Well, not really special, but we wanted to basically release a video to cap out the end of the year. And what better than to just talk about our favorite games? And, you know, initially we debated maybe we should do like a top five and the worst game. But then, you know, I don't want to spread more negativity. So we just decided to do.
I also don't want to steal concepts from people more so than a top five list is already doing.
Exactly. So we're going to be doing just our favorite games of this year. Not, as Callum said, not necessarily games that came out this year, although those can be on the list, but just what were the games that we played this year that we liked and, you know, why. So I thought I would get things going off talking about my fifth favorite game. And I will give you a guess as to what it is. It involves a gruff, manly dude with kind of no personality and lots of murder.
Of every game that's come out in the last 20 years.
Well, it helps that it's based on some classic fantasy literature.
Oh, Dante's Inferno.
No, but close. It's Middle Earth, Shadow of Mordor.
Really?
Yeah, that's my fifth favorite game. So I am not a person that plays a lot of action games. I don't play a lot of open world games, but I do like games where you can do kind of like a hybrid of stealth and you know, murder. And I think that Middle Earth's Shadow of Mordor caught my eye for a number of reasons. I think one of the reasons is that it does something really different with the Tolkien lore, right? A lot of people who
does it though.
Well, I mean,
Still orcs and fighting.
Yeah, but I mean, the orcs have a character. You can kind of humanize them in a way that they aren't really humanized in Lord of the Rings. And also, you know, vengeance is kind of like a vengeance and power fantasy is really like an anti-theme in, you know, Lord of the Rings. It's like you really shouldn't be trying to get vengeance. Vengeance is a dark road. You know, it's the little people who doing little acts of heroism that make the day. Shadow of Mordor is you're basically Batman with a sword. Go murder like infinity orcs. And yeah, that's what it is. You know, there is even a joke to Batman in the game.
And, there is? Yeah, no, wait, you have to tell me this.
Yeah, what, okay, so
what is the joke?
If I'm not mistaken, so how the healing system works is that Talion, the player character, is already dead, right? He was already killed at the start of the game, and his body is being possessed by an elf spirit, Celebrimbor, who has got a really funny name. And you can't really die, because if you die, you just kind of respawn because of the curse and so on and so forth. But if you take damage, you heal by picking up herbs. You have to find some herbs. And every time you pick up a herb, if it's the first time that you've seen it, it'll give you like a little... And in Middle Earth, the hobbits use this herb to make calzones or something like that. And
hey, Sam, let's go and take this ring.
It's a me, Frodo.
That's the worst joke I've ever made. That's the worst joke we've ever made.
Oh, the night is young, Callum. The night is young. And yeah, so one of the herbs that you can collect is hallucinogenic. in terms of like the effects that it has on orcs who eat it. And the blurb says, when these orcs consume this herb, they have terrible visions of a hooded, bat-like figure stalking them from the shadows. Oh, and it's God. Like, that's a Batman reference in a Tolkien game. Okay.
Wow.
Yeah, you know, it's not... Let me say this. It's not
incredible.
It's not the perfect game. That's why it's actually only fifth. I like a lot of the ideas. It is fun to ride a Karago, which is like a lion version of a warg. You know, it's fun to do that. It's fun to fight the orcs. The orcs have interesting personalities. The nemesis system is really fun. You can like selectively, you could be like a fairy godmother to like an orc chieftain and like help him in his power struggles against his rivals, and like watching from the shadows with like, you know, with your bow ready to shoot his enemy, and you know, come, you know, to you know, make sure that he rises to power and you can control him. So those are all the things that's fun about the game. It has some jank, as is, you know, fitting a game that's quite old. Sometimes you will like do like a Yakety Sax kind of impression with like 50 orcs just chasing you around a stronghold because I messed up the stealth section, and now every orc in like half of Mordor knows where I am. But it is a fun game. I finished it fairly quickly. And let me say this, having played Dishonored, not killing anyone, it was fun to play a stealth game where non-violence is not an option. And yeah, it was fun. So that's my fifth game.
I totally agree with you. It's a very nice game. I used to play it while exercising. And my only real problem with it was that Talion is very boring.
He has no personality. True to form, I actually liked the DLC where you play as Celebrimbor more, because Celebrimbor at least has like a personality. But yeah, Talion is just very, very boring. But yeah, that's one of the reasons why it's only fifth. All right, so what's your fifth game?
Number five for Callum.
Number five
is it's also kind of an old game. I only picked it up this year after a Steam sale. It's Super Hot.
Oh, Super Hot, Super Hot, Super Hot. Yeah,
I knew you were going to do that.
I had to. I'm contractually obliged.
I enjoyed myself with it, but afterwards I kind of never thought about it again, which is my fifth game, which is why it's my fifth game.
For those of you who aren't familiar, what is exactly, why is Super Hot, and why did I start chanting it at the beginning of the game, title?
Okay, so Super Hot is an indie game, I think, and you are a person on your computer. It's immersive already. And you get an instant message from your friend who's like, have you checked out this new game? I have a crack. Here you go. And you download it and you start playing it. And basically, you're a guy who needs to kill all of the red guys in the room, in the level that you're in. But time will only move when you do.
Yes, that's really awesome.
It's a very cool concept. It's like bullet time taken to its final extreme, and I liked it a lot. It is a little finicky, though, at certain levels, and the whole game's about flow. It's about like carefully planning out your strategy and then reacting to the situation around you as it evolves, and it gets a little annoying. Yeah, it's kind of like an adventure game.
It gets
a little bit annoying.
It's a puzzle game where the puzzle is bullets and the solution is your fists.
Yeah. It gets a little bit annoying when you clear out an entire room and then some dick spawns in behind you with a shotgun. And you're like, you have to turn around to look at him, but turning moves time, so all of his bullets perforate you.
I see. So
That's why it's at five.
That's why it's at five. So let me ask you this. The story of Super Hot is kind of minimalist, right? But it does have a story.
Kind of. Yeah. The story is that you're not supposed to be playing this game. The corporation who owns it, it's very confusing. It's like, it's kind of trying to say that everyone in this game is real, and these are real people that you're murdering, and you're controlling a drone, essentially. And what you think, it's like a cartoon episode where someone thinks it's a video game, but it's like a tactical drone from the US military. And you're basically just murdering people.
Well, yeah, you know, that's it. I think the fun in Superhot is that, you know, a lot of people watch John Wick movies and then they look at it and go, wow, that's really awesome. You know, I wish I could, you know, I wish I could do that. Or, you know, I wish I could play a game like that. And what they don't realize is that a John Wick fight sequence is like 90% planning of the fight sequence and like 10% actually doing it, right? So a game like Superhot is like, okay, well, now you need to think. You've got like three guys over there, you've four guys over there, you've got one gun and a spoon. How are you going to, you know, like deal with the situation? And the
fact that I actually haven't watched John Wick, but I get what you're saying.
Yeah, we have to maybe do a movie night where we watch John Wick, because John Wick is a really good movie. Definitely one of the better action movies to come out. But anyway,
I got to the point where Theon Greyjoy kills Neo's dog, and then his dad just like, "Oh, you've summoned a demon, basically. Get out of here."
I really like how so many video game plots are basically just the plot of John Wick.
I mean, yeah.
You have a character, flimsy, emotional, like, segue into ultra-violent, you know, chain of destruction. But I think Superhot is also important because, you know, it has kind of helped kickstart a wave of, like, related games, especially, I think, on VR. Like, Superhot walked so that a game like Boneworks could run, you know?
Yeah, I also think it's important because it was successful when it came out, and it's a game that did something different, and everyone saw that, and they started making games not like Superhot, but which also did different things. And that's really cool to me, because if Superhot was a AAA game, just about everyone on Earth would have been playing Superhot, except this time it's Mario.
What? Oh man, you have to fight the Goombas, but you have to jump in three-dimensional space, but time only moves when you say, "It's a me, a Mario."
I mean, dude, they did a XCOM style shooting strategy with rabbits. Like, I'm not writing anything off.
Yeah, they did. They totally did.
Speaking of horrific decisions, what's your fourth game of the year?
Okay. So this is a game that actually does, in fact, mention Superhot. So this is really funny. and it's a game that is also about guns and the thrill of ultraviolence. Caleb, nice. Let me ask you this question. Can a gun be a frog that burps, and the burps are bullets?
I've had a dream like this.
Well, if you were dreaming about Enter the Gungeon, then in fact, that's the dream that you had. So, Enter the Gungeon is my fourth favorite game.
What an incredible sentence!
Every sentence that basically most of the guns in Enter the Gungeon are an example of like an r/rare sentence, because, you know, there's a gun that is a bundle of wands taped together that shoot random magical effects.
Oh, nice.
There is a gun that is just a banana, and and when you throw it, it turns into a peel, which explodes, if I'm not mistaken. There is a gun that is just a super soaker. That's it. It's just a super soaker. And then there is a gun that is just a letter R that shoots the word bullet. It's a gun that says the word bullet, and then the word bullet turns, and the letters explode. It's really awesome.
So, okay, so for those of you who don't know, what would Superhot be? I mean, not Superhot, shit. so, take two. What would Enter the Gungeon be?
Right, so Enter the Gungeon is a roguelike some would say roguelite. We probably do an episode on the difference between those two terms. But it's a roguelike game where you play as a character called a Gungeoneer. And there is a place in far-off distant space called the Gungeon, where fortunes are won and lost, where brave souls come to die and face the mystical challenges of the Gungeon. It is essentially...
Yeah, like a Tuesday.
Yeah, basically a Tuesday. So it's a place where people go, and once you go there, you can't leave. You get trapped in kind of like an eternal cycle of rebirth and running in the Gungeon, because...
Wow.
Yeah, it's the Dark Souls of gun-based roguelike games. Actually, Enter the Gungeon is just a game full of references. I said a reference to Super Hot. There is a Super Hot watch that when you activate it, time only moves when you move. Literally,
that's awesome.
It's awesome, you know, because if you have difficulty navigating, all the bullet hell elements of the game, then that's something that's for you. There is actually a Dark Soul. When you die, you have to go back and collect your souls from your body. There's an Estus Flask.
I love this.
It's awesome.
I don't know.
So,
well,
how Gungeon?
Okay, but let me ask you a question.
Yeah.
You don't like Borderlands, right?
No, I don't. I can almost preempt the question that you're going. So why do I like a game like this and why don't I like a game like Borderlands? Am I right?
Kind of.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So my problem with Borderlands is that for the most part, I mean, there's an okay story, right? You know, an okay story with some interesting characters.
You don't have to be nice. There's a shit story with annoying characters.
Okay, yeah. It's kind of the people who wrote the story they're not working with a lot. And, you know, the fact that Randy Pitchford is the CEO of Gearbox kind of indicates, like, yeah, story isn't the most important. But the main selling point of Borderlands is that here are gazillion guns. And how it works in the game is that they are randomizing bits and bobs. And you're always looking for the next number increase, right? You're never really finding a gun like, this is the gun, right? Because you can just random, you know, dig in a trash can like two minutes later, and then you find a gun that's better than your favorite gun, you know, in basically every conceivable way. And that is a problem because it makes every of the weapons kind of feel disposable. You know, it doesn't really feel like, oh, this is a interesting gun, and, you know, so on and so forth. It's kind of the problem of, like, you have too much variety, so everything becomes meaningless. Enter the Gungeon, on the other hand, doesn't do that. Instead, it has a limited number of very different guns, right? So they come up with, like, I think there are like 300 or something weapons or something like that in the game. Then they're like, okay, here are all the guns. Each of the gun has a particular gimmick. Each of the guns are different from one another. And then they add on something called synergies, where a gun can gain special behavior if it is tied to, like, an item. So for example, if you've got, what's a good example?
I have no idea.
Let's say you've got the hexagun. The Witch's Revolver, which is a really cool gun. It's a 45 Magnum, but it has a chance to cast Polymorph on any target that you hit, right? So if
awesome.
You have the Witch's Gun and you have the bundle of wands, then you have the two weapons have a magical effect with one another, and you can, you know, have more powerful effects. Or let's say, for example, you have you get the pig. There is a pig that follows you around, and if you die, he will jump heroically in front of the bullet, and then you have to, and then he, you know, you're like, I avenged you, and then he, you know, it's really adorable. So you've got the pig, but then let's say you get the gun that's like the flower pot gun, then the pig is like, you know, more, he gets more powerful, and maybe the gun changes hands. Or, you know, there are lots of different synergies, and the synergies are all unique. And the point is that you never feel as if, really, you know, every gun is the same. Because, you know, many of the guns are similar, but they all can do various different things, and they can dramatically change the way that you play the game based on what you get when, right? Because the other thing is that I think goes for it is that this is a roguelike. Dying is easy. In fact, at the beginning of the game, before the game is even loaded, if you just push Y, you will just quick start into the game. Right? That's one of the things that I love about it. you can just immediately just jump into to playing. And if you die, well, you can start over, and you don't really have to worry about the overarching story. It's just a challenge dungeon in a sense.
And, oh, nice.
Yeah, I play this game when I want to relax, because I don't have to really think about it too much. I just have to, you know, dodge the bullets on the screen and shoot the guys back. And
oh, you know, the relaxation of ultra-violence.
You know what? I'm one of those people that I get... If I'm really, really focused into a thing, I can find that relaxing. You know, because Enter the Gungeon is not too difficult, I think. I've beaten it several times. And I'm not the best, you know, hardcore min-maxer out there. I'm not, like, posting my speedruns on speedrun.com. But, yeah, you know, I find it...
It blows me away that it's called speedrun.com. It sounds so pedestrian.
Fortunes are won and lost on speedrun.com. And speaking of losing, what is your fourth game, Callum?
My fourth game is another roguelike.
Oh, okay.
Sort of. Like, a bit. And it's something I've been wanting to play for a while, and it's also something I use to relax, but it's a bit more contemplative, I think, than Enter the Violence. It's FTL Faster Than Light.
Ah, oh, man, that is a good game. FTL Faster Than Light. So, would this be accurate? FTL is basically Star Trek, but in a different space-time.
It's kind of like Star Trek in that you play it by... I'm sorry if it sounds like I can't say anything today. It's very hot.
Yeah, Callum needs he needs to get like a coolant injector.
I mean, honestly, December in South Africa is like June on the sun.
Yeah, but at least it does rain, you know?
I wish it was raining right now. But anyway, FTL is like Star Trek in the sense that you can divert energy and crew members to specific rooms to increase their effectiveness. And you're basically, it's like a almost turn-based fighting with ships.
It's a real time, but you can pause at any time, if I'm not mistaken.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And every weapon requires like load time.
Mm-hmm.
So it ends up becoming almost turn-based, because if you're shooting each other at the same time, and you're in like a similar technical bracket, then your weapons will generally load at the same time.
Yeah.
And you can say, oh, mine shoot first, and his are like specifically missile-based, so they're going to miss a lot more. Then you can plan around that. It's a game that rewards tactics.
FTL is a puzzle game, but the puzzle is essentially solving a season of Star Trek.
What I like about it is how it rewards you for just growing.
Hmm.
You know, you spend scrap on upgrades for your ship and buying new crew members and new rooms to your ship so that you can change your playstyle as you go. Like, my favorite ship right now is the Engi ship, which has no weapons. It just has drones.
Oh, yeah. And the Engi ship, I think all the crewmen can... It doesn't have a med bay, so the crewmen can automatically heal.
Yeah, it has a special piece of technology that if your med bay has energy in it, the entire ship acts as the med bay.
Yes.
But I recently unlocked the second layout for it, which has a ton of weapons and no crew. There's only one crew member.
Oh.
You have drones for repairs and like forced entry. So if someone tries to get onto your ship, you have a defense drone that goes and takes care of them.
It's the I don't need friends, meet my robot.
It's really great because you can decide the story of your own ship, but you're also working ironically for the Empire this time, and the dastardly rebels are trying to take over your dang galaxy.
Yeah, FTL does this really interesting thing where the good guys of the story are the Federation, who are a multi-species coalition of like different alien races and humans, of course. And the bad guys of the story are the rebels, who are like a pro-human supremacist organization, and they just want to kill all the aliens.
I mean, and this, it really does come down to what I've always said. There has never been a good empire in any sci-fi or fantasy, and the only way to change that is to not call yourself the Empire. Because Star Trek, the Federation is basically just like the Imperial Empire. but everyone loves them.
Ooh, that's a hot take. There are some Star Trek fans right now that are probably really, really angry with you.
Send me a tweet.
Go on Reddit. Go on our subreddit and
just get really mad
and angry. Do post it. About it.
I feed off it.
Yeah, but so the game is mostly tactical. But if I recall correctly, there's also a choose your own adventure side to it.
Yeah, you respond to distress signals, which set up. That's where the roguelike elements come in. It sets up like a scenario, which you have to pick options. And it's kind of a 50-50 on whether it works, and you might get something from it or lose something. Like, I can't tell you how many distress beacons I've gone to that have turned out to be abandoned ships. And every single time, it is either just free money or, like, four aliens who are all combat geniuses that want to kill my guys. But then I just depressurize my whole ship and hide my crew in the medbay.
I think my favorite... because I've beaten FTL once. I've only ever beaten it once. And I think that was.
I have never beaten it, so you're doing better than me.
Because for viewers at home, I think the difficulty of FTL is that the basic idea is that you have to get your ship to the Federation from way out in deep space and to tell them, hey, there's a rebellion going on, although they probably know by the time you get there. And the final boss of the game, spoiler alert, is the flagship of the entire Rebel fleet, which is a ginormous spaceship, bigger than anything that you've ever faced.
So difficult to fight.
Yeah.
It has all the upgraded stuff. And so the point is that you're trying to upgrade your ship to take them out.
Yeah.
You're basically trying to destroy the Rebel flagship.
Yeah. It's like if, you know, the Rebel Alliance were like, hey, let's send one X-Wing against the Star Destroyer, you know, but that better be a souped up X-Wing. But the thing about FTL is that there's a lot of, I think, genius to the writing in terms of like the different stories and like the different like attitudes. I think my favorite event is when you go to a space station and they're like, we're being attacked by giant alien spiders. And then I'm like,
yeah,
okay.
Oh, shit.
And, you know, there are so many different ways that you can resolve that different event based on like what you have. Like you can send some of your crew to help, but maybe the spiders will eat them and you'll lose a guy. Or maybe you'll be like,
yeah,
I have an anti-life form laser. Let me just zap them. And you're just like sitting in space shooting at the spiders with your laser. And yeah.
I like that a lot as well. It's also quite a contemplative story because you end up having to make snap decisions when you're low on fuel or health and another fight has come up. And it's the options are like fight the enemies who are attacking the station or steal supplies from the refugees while they flee.
Yeah, the game really makes you question, like, how are we the baddies here? Like, is the Federation really bad? Or, you know, what am I personal? Am I going to let these people die just because, you know, I can loot their corpse for scrap? Or am I going to, like, play the hero and get my ship beat up and maybe not make it out of the sector? It really is a personal story. That I think is really well made, because a lot of roguelikes don't give you that sense of feeling that you're actually, you know, part of an unfolding narrative. I totally think that someone could turn like a long play session of FTL into like a sci-fi show, you know?
Yeah, that's actually why it's at my fourth and not higher up on the list, even though I like it so much, is that it's a big time commitment for a game that you're not even necessarily supposed to win. Because there's no guarantee that when you get to the end that you'll be able to face and defeat the rebels. And there's a lot of guarantee that you won't and you'll die. And to sink an hour into this only to lose at the end and go at it from the beginning again is a bit too much of a commitment.
It can be demoralizing. I remember when I won the first time, I haven't played the game since.
Well, hopefully I will stick with it throughout. Because it's really nice to listen to podcasts ever since we tore Elite Dangerous to shreds. I haven't touched it.
Nice. So I think it's a good segue into my third favorite game. And you'll never believe it, Callum. It's not FTL, but it is the next game that was produced by Subset Games, the maker of FTL, and that's Into the Breach.
What?
Yes.
On Earth is Into the Breach.
So FTL is a game of, it's a game of kind of like you are a space captain on a space quest you're Chad, Big Dad, Thunder Chad, you know, except you get a lot more meaningful interaction with the galaxy and you don't have to spend like 50 hours.
You're Chad, thoughtful Chad.
Yeah, it's real thoughtful time. Well, the combat of FTL is, you know, kind of frenetic in a way where it can be like you're desperately waiting for like your missiles to charge up so you can maybe like send out a salvo and beat the enemy before they beat you. Into the Breach is kind of the opposite idea. Instead of being a Star Trek, it's more like Pacific Rim meets a puzzle game. So Into the Breach is one of my...
No, hang on. You can't say something ridiculous like that.
Yeah, that's exactly
so what... So are you fighting giant kaijus, but you have to play like Bejeweled?
Okay. So the idea is that you're an elite superhero... Well, not superhero, but you're an elite super team of radical pilots who are time traveling, or actually not really time traveling. You're multiverse hopping, right? Because your homeworld was originally overrun by an alien species called the Vec, and you jumped to another dimension to hopefully beat the Vec before they destroyed your planet, which is Earth.
The Vec.
They're bug aliens, but huge bug aliens.
Ah, Vec.
No one makes that joke in the game, unfortunately, which is really sad.
Missed gold.
So Into the Breach is a game of... You have a team of mecha, and at the beginning of every battle, you deploy. The team jumps in from like high above. It's really cool, and it's a puzzle game. And I seriously mean that, because everything that is going to happen, like the effect of every action, like here's the thing: the effect of every action is known to you beforehand. So like you know what moves the enemy are going to take, right? It tells you. It's a turn-based game that you know what moves the enemy are going to take, and you know what the effect of those moves will be. Right. So, for example, let's say there are like three giant moth creatures, right? And each of them is doing a different thing. When you click end turn, they will do those things. So you actually have to figure out a way to either kill them, you know, before their turn takes effect, their part of the turn, or you have to manipulate them by moving them around. A lot of the you get three mechs, and typically each mech has like a speciality. So like some mechs are good at moving the Vec. Some of them are good at like causing environmental effects, and some of them are just like straight up good at dealing damage.
That's pretty interesting.
So the three different kinds of ideas is basically that straight up killing the Vec is really not kind of the goal for the most part, because A, they can continuously spawn in. Like one of the important mechanics of the game is the ability to like stop the Vec from spawning. Like every turn you'll see that on the ground there'll be like a sinkhole that's going to emerge, and it's like, ah, in two turns a Vec is going to show up. But if you put a unit on top of that hole, then not only will the Vec not appear, but the unit on top will actually get damaged, right? So like it's a puzzle game of like figuring out how to maneuver the Vec around, you know, the space, in order to like efficiently manage them and like protect your cities, because like you have to protect a city's, you know, on the map, and the Vec are trying to destroy them, and you're trying to protect them. And like, if they get destroyed, then you get like a little animation that's like, "No, the cities are dead! Ah, chaos!" You know. It's also a roguelike. So every time you start a new campaign,
we're really into roguelikes.
We are so into roguelikes. I think that is probably one of the reasons why we get along on this podcast. Secretly, we're just really both into roguelikes. And I also listen to podcasts while I play Into the Breach. That's what replaced Faster Than Light. Into the Breach is really fun. It's really difficult though. I haven't ever managed to actually even beat like one of the bosses of the game.
Holy shit.
I've never managed to beat like the first boss of like, you know, the first island, I think it is. Because like, so here's the rub. Like, you know what's going to happen, right? But you still only have a limited ability to do something about it. Like every mech can only do like one move and one attack, right? So, you know, you might think, okay, well, if I move this Vec to that place and then I, push him over there and I do this, then yeah, sure, I'll like minimize the damage. But it's not always necessarily the case that every puzzle has like an optimal, truly optimal solution. Sometimes it's just you've got to make the best of a bad situation. And you know, one of the things about it is like maybe you'll play, but then maybe you'll unlock like a new mech team, or maybe you'll find like a new pilot that you can use in your roster. And
yeah, I love stuff like that. Like it gives you a genuine gameplay change and a reason to keep going, but it isn't just like, oh, you do more damage.
Yeah, exactly. And you know, I love the pixel art. I'm a sucker for, you know, pixel art. And I really like the look of it. I will say the game is much harder than FTL, right? The win-lose margins are a lot narrower. But on the other hand, it's much quicker to play the game. Like every map takes like maybe 5 minutes, you know, 10 minutes. A campaign is like, playing like a couple of missions is like maybe like 35, 40 minutes. It's not like FTL where you can invest like an hour and still, you know, be heading towards the flagship. Here it's like much more decisive, I think.
Well, I guess they found, they heard what their fans were saying and they took it to heart.
We want a Power Rangers game, but everyone is sad.
I love that shit. So Power Rangers and Ultraman, and I've never watched Ultraman, so maybe I shouldn't mention it, but Power Rangers and shit is my jam. Or it was. I'm so keen to play that game.
And speaking of jam, what is your next?
Okay, we can't start every segment with speaking of, because now I am expected to do something with jam as a concept. My next game has absolutely nothing to do with jam.
Oh,
except
no.
That you seem to be in one all the time.
Oh, and is it Disco Elysium?
I was about to say, we've been talking about this game all year, basically. Yes, it is Disco Elysium.
I knew it.
Okay. Do I even need to tell people?
Yes.
I mean, if you've watched our videos, you know what Disco Elysium is about.
But hey, you know, this could be someone's first introduction to the show. We should definitely tell them.
Why are you starting at the top five? Anyway, Disco Elysium is great. Buy it. Emilio, your third game. No, Disco Elysium is a book that you get to play.
Okay.
It's a lot of reading. You pick a character based like on whether they're a bit more brutal, so they're more physical, whether they're a bit more emotional, so they can like talk to people better, or intelligent. And it's basically just D&D, except you're a drunk detective in future New Orleans post a communist revolution.
It's so radical. Like, here's the thing. I don't really want to talk too much about Disco Elysium because it is a story-based game that really requires like your input, you know, to get the best out of it. So we're not going to do any spoilers, but I think you should definitely tell them about like the way it handles like dialogue and stuff like that, because it's not just pick a text box, you know.
Okay, say you click on a person that you want to have a conversation with, and they're chatting to you, and you have a skill, or you put a skill point in, say, pain threshold. Now you're a crazy person who is also an addict. So your brain will, using the voice of pain threshold as a concept, will say, hey, I bet you could fight this guy. Do you want to? And then you talk to yourself, to rather that aspect of your personality for a bit, and that's supplementing the dialogue. So it ends up being that you're not necessarily just talking to the people around you, but to the voices in your head, which are each their own unique characters trying to convince you to do things.
Yeah, it's not just a bland, oh, you know, pick a text option, or like a Mass Effect Paragon Renegade. It's, I'm going to have a Socratic dialogue with my own inner fears and, you know, spices, and then I'm going to be like, what should I do? Punch this guy? I don't know. Maybe I should. My lizard brain is telling me that violence is the answer.
And you know what I would recommend, if you do pick up Disco Elysium, is have two saves. One save where you play is how you would do it, because that's how I'm doing it right now. And you end up being kind of boring, because you're picking all of the sensible options. And then the other save, just have fun with it. Axel kick the guy in front of you. Just say, fuck it. Call yourself a superstar and sing karaoke, which are both options.
I mean, it is called Disco Elysium.
Yeah, your disco is hell.
I don't know. What more could we say about the game without spoiling it?
Oh, the reason it's at my third, yes, instead of my first, even though I have been talking about it for a year and just licking it all over, num 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 num, is because it ruins itself with one of its mechanics.
Oh.
This was also said in a zero punctuation review, but it's my own opinion, I promise. You can change clothes in the game, and doing so will edit your stats. So how it works is if you have to like jump over something, or you want to talk to someone and a dialogue option comes up, it will require you to do a check, where it will do a dice roll based on a percentage that is given for how much skill points you've invested into that skill. But if you wear certain clothing, you can sort of fudge the numbers a bit. What that means is that you can get into a conversation, exit out of it, change all your clothes so that you're the most optimized you can be, and then get back into it. And that makes it a bit too video gamey, which kind of pulls you out of the experience. I would love it if it was just like, oh, you can pick clothes and they might give you like a weird sort of vague effect, but they're not quite so prominent.
If maybe the game hinted at what the clothes could do rather than, you know, like just out and out just give you a bonus.
Yeah, because then it would maintain that getting new clothes is a good thing that changes gameplay, but you wouldn't be super sure what everything would do, and so you wouldn't be able to accurately predict what your clothes are giving you. That would bring its own problems, but I think it would also maintain the themes of the game a bit better.
I think there's a problem. For a game to be, you know, not just an interactive movie, there have to be, you know, elements of actual gameplay, right? And
yeah.
With something like Disco Elysium, I feel as if you know, a mechanic like this is an attempt to be like, okay, this is not just an interactive movie, you know. You can, if you want, you know, do some actual quote-unquote gaming. But yeah, you know, it's probably
a weird thing to latch onto as the gameplay mechanic. I would have loved a gameplay mechanic where I have to fill in like a notepad that like appears on my screen because you're a detective. And you do have a really cool section at the one of the points in the beginning where you have to do a field autopsy.
Oh.
And you have to fill it in and you can have fun with it or whatever. But I would love a portion of the game where you do actually just have to solve this case.
You actually just have to do detective stuff.
Yeah.
I wonder if that would really, you know, because I mean, there's always been attempts to make like quote-unquote police procedural games. And I feel as if a lot of like the more minute details of the whole thing sometimes maybe take people out of it. But I don't know. I think that's one that we could definitely talk about, like whether or not we could actually make a police procedural game.
I think you can, but I think you have to, it would have to be something like a cross between Papers, Please and maybe a slightly more action heavy thing.
Is that, are we just describing LA Noir?
LA Noir, but better.
LA Noir, but it's set in like Aristotska and you have to drive a horse buggy.
Your third game, please.
Okay. So I think there's a common theme about a bunch of the games on this list. Roguelikes, heavy political themes, ultraviolence.
We are basic leftists.
Yeah, I mean, I read theory. I mean, I actually do, but that's not a joke. So this game, my number two game, is a game that I only recently started playing, but has just so blown me away that I had to put it at number two. And that is Brigador by Stellar Jockeys. So, Callum, great leader has fallen. You must kill. That is essentially what happens at the beginning of the game. Now, picture this. You're piloting a mech, walking down a highway, right? There are cars abandoned by their residents. You're stepping on them. A warning siren is in the distance. You know, you
Wait,
hear
the... you're stepping on them?
You're stepping on the cars. Yeah, and the people who don't get out of the way in time. And, you know, there's a warning siren. There's a word, the words, great leader has fallen, you know, time to kill. And, you know, that's Brigador. Brigador is a game that is kind of like Mech Warrior, but, you know, very, very, very 80s. It has a killer synth soundtrack. Basically, the plot of the game is that there's a planet called Sobre Nova or something to that effect. And there's a corporation that wants the planet. But the planet is run by, or at least it was run by, a militaristic dictatorship run by a great leader. Fortunately for the corporation, you know, there's an opening. Great leader has recently been killed. The entire planet is kind of thrown into chaos. An anarcho-syndicalist uprising has happened on the planet with party buses. Hello?
Yeah? Oh, no, I'm listening. I'm just enraptured.
I was expecting you to say, like, what are you talking about, Emilio? What is this game?
I'm struck dumb.
So yeah, a brigador is a fighter in Portuguese. So you are literally a mech pilot who has to accept contracts from a corporation to destabilize the remnants of a political militaristic dictatorship, and also deal with like an anarcho-syndicalist uprising by a gang called the Corvids, who literally. Okay.
Oh gosh, that's topical.
Yeah, it's.
you know, society's being overthrown by something called the Corvid. Are there 19 of them?
There are. Well, I mean, considering they have enough people to have like suicide bombers, there's probably a lot more than 19. So you pilot a mech, and you can pilot one of three kinds, right? You can pilot something with like tank treads, or something, you know, that is like an anti-gravity vehicle, or something with actual mech legs, right? You've got two weapons, a primary weapon and a secondary weapon, plus a special ability, which is like an EMP or a smoke grenade or something like that. And, you know, there are different kinds of weapons, like machine guns and lasers and all that stuff. But there are so many different kinds of mechs, right? You know, every faction has a mech that, like, reflects the design philosophy of that mech. Like, for example, the Corvids are a ragtag anarcho-syndicalist uprising. So they have, like, a tank, which is just a party bus dropped onto a tank chassis. And when you
that's awesome.
And when you push the horn, it's like you know that stereotypical like like that. It just, and then you could just drive around in a fury, just gunning everything down with your party bus minigun.
Hell yes.
Yeah, but then also, you know, there's a faction called the Spacers, and they're like, you know, Elon Musk basically, because they're like, we live in space, we're better than you peasants.
Do you have to play as them?
Well, you can play as some of their mechs. You fight them for the campaign, right? For the campaign, you are a mech warrior, a brigador, working for, you know, the SNC Corporation, I think it is. And you can fight basically all three of the factions because the company wants all of them out of the planet before it moves in and, you know, starts doing corporation stuff. But you can use like spacer mechs, which are like very 80s retro themed. Like they look a lot like repurposed like lunar modules and things like that.
Oh, rad.
Yeah, and the other thing is, of course, everything is destructible, right? You can step on the barricades, you can step on the people, you can blow up all the buildings.
So I may have missed you saying it earlier. Is this another 2D pixelated side-scrolly kind of thing?
It's isometric.
Okay, so it's like Bastion.
Yeah, it's like Bastion if someone put like a really dirty filter over Bastion and then like filled it with neon.
I have never played Bastion, so that might just be the case. It was a bad example to pick, sorry.
Yeah, you know, you control the mech with, you know, a mouse and keyboard, aiming is really actually like important because like your weapons will have to like lead time and the enemy's driving like a suicide tuk-tuk, and if you don't get him correctly, he'll take out like one of your legs.
I love the word suicide tuk-tuk.
Callum, there's a unit in this game which is literally just a tuk-tuk with a giant pole attached to it so someone can use binoculars to see.
Yeah, this is Mad Max, but it's like Mad Max Durban Road.
Yeah, well, some of the enemies, the Corvids, use tuk-tuks, but like other, you know, the loyalists, the remnants of the dictator's regime, they have military hardware, their spaces, they're doing their own thing, you know, with their own technology. It really is just a fun game, and it doesn't have too much of a story, right? You know, at the campaign, it's like, oh, you know, you've got to take out an orbital gun, but it's really just an excuse to go wild in a pseudo-sandbox, like, destruction environment, you know, trading blows with the enemy, trying to find them, outflank them, you know, not get overwhelmed. And also, here's the fun thing, right? Once you beat the campaign...
That wasn't the fun thing?
Once you beat the campaign, you enter freelance mode, where you can pick a pilot from a list of different pilots, right? They all have different backstories and bios and abilities. Like, the best pilot in the game is maybe, like, a skeleton with, like, a smiley face drawn over his face. Like, he's wearing, like, a plate, a paper plate, and it's got, like, a smiley face, but you can clearly see he's a skeleton underneath. And you pick a mech... And then you just, you know, do missions for cash money. And the smaller mech that you pick, the more money you get at the end of it. So like, yeah, you can just play as the tuk-tuk and drive around trying to like take out like a skyscraper, you know, size mech.
What this has taught me is that we need to start sharing each other's Steam libraries, because this sounds rad as hell.
Brigador is so rad. It is really, you know, it's got a great soundtrack. It's got great, you know, environmental storytelling. Like, if you take down the substations, all the buildings become depowered. Everyone starts running around. You can blow up a golf course. It's really fun. Yeah, it's just, it's all around a great game. And if you didn't have to, like, buy the story with your in-game money, like, there's, like, lore and stuff. There's, like, a whole lore encyclopedia in the game. But you buy the entries with money. You know,
that's weird.
It's meant to, like, you're a corporate mercenary. In fact, you even have to buy your contract in pieces. Like, you buy the terms of service in pieces.
Does it give you anything?
Well, you
or is it just, like, for completionist's sake?
Well, you can unlock weapons and mechs and pilots, right? That's like the, oh, you buy the stuff with your in-game currency, right? There's, you know, no microtransactions. But if you want to buy, like, lore, then you have to buy it with also the same currency. It's not too expensive. It's just, like, you know, for winning a mission, you can get like a couple million, you know, dollars, and then you just spend that on like, you know, whatever. But it's not too story focused, to the point that the company is actually like, yeah, you know, a lot of people like, this is a really good story. You know, there's like a nice, interesting background world. You know, where is all of that? And they're like, okay, yeah, fine. So the next game, I think Brigador 2, the Electric Boogaloo, working title, is more story focused.
Lol. I've never even watched whatever the movie it was that called the... I think it was Saturday Night Fever that originally did Electric Boogaloo. But it is everyone's go-to. I love it.
It's such a fun word to say, Callum.
It's so whimsical. And you know what isn't whimsical?
Your second game.
Hell. But oh. You know what is whimsical?
Hades?
Being gay.
Yes, it's Hades.
So it's Hades. really, we are just the same person in two different bodies, because I have also picked an isometric game for my second game.
Oh.
But this one's another roguelike.
Yes.
Which is nuts. You play as the son of Hades, Zagreus.
Yay!
You want to leave.
Yeah.
You were going to say something?
No, I was going to say, is he a strong, handsome man?
He's a strong, handsome twink.
Yeah.
No, he's not a twink. He's really built. He's like an otter.
Yeah.
No, he's not hairy enough. I don't know what the term is.
Yeah, I'm not familiar. Viewers at home, please comment what the actual correct term is.
Yes.
For a muscular but not very hairy gay dude. Well, he's technically not. He's not fully gay. He can be straight, or he can be gay, or he can be bisexual.
I have not gotten far enough in the game to start exploring his sexuality.
Yes, but first you must kill.
Yeah, basically, you live in Hades, and you don't like it. Because everything's the same all the time. And that's important, because the whole game is about this, essentially. And you want to escape Hades. To do that, you have to go through, like, four isometric levels of the various levels of Hades itself, of hell. And then when you get to the top, you fight your dad and you leave, and then you start all over again.
Well, it's not a video game unless you have to kill your father, who is also a god, you know?
Yeah, except the thing is, you're all gods, and everyone seems to be aware that they can't die, really. So it doesn't seem to matter that much. Everyone's kind of like, you get killed and you go back home and you find the first boss that you killed sitting in the bar just
chilling,
having a drink, and you talk to them and they're like, yeah, I'm kind of miffed at you, but whatever.
Really interesting.
What I like about Hades is that it's one of those games that once you get into it, it's difficult enough to be challenging and interesting, and yet interesting enough story-wise to make me want to keep playing. Because every time you try and escape, you'll run into some new thing, even if it's just a new conversation with someone. And every time you do escape, it unlocks the story a bit more. I've heard from my friend that you have to beat it like 14 times before you get the full story.
Oh, okay.
And it's only second place on my list because it's a little repetitive.
Hmm.
I
imagine that, like, the thing to roguelike games is that you really have to have so much, you know, variety. Like with FTL, with Into the Breach, with Enter the Gungeon, you've really got to have a lot of variety to sell the game. Otherwise, you know, it's got to be short enough to give a lot of novelty for the time that it has.
I don't know why I like roguelike so much on this specific list, because I hate randomness in games. I truly detest it, and I don't like running through a dungeon with a weapon that I chose and getting power-ups, and they're all random, and I might get, like, a completely useless power-up.
Hmm.
Or the only good power-ups would replace the one I have, which is better, so I have to get a useless one. And you could go through the whole thing and just have a bad run, and that's why you lose. And that sucks to me. I don't like that.
So, to what degree, you know, because the other important thing for a roguelike is that some amount of it has to depend on your player's... Well, you can strike a balance between depending on your player's skill or depending on your items. Like, with Enter the Gungeon, you kind of can salvage the game with just no items, really, although having more items makes it better. How much of that is true for Hades?
In Hades, where I am right now, upgrades-wise, you have 2 lives. If you die, you defy death once, and then you can die again. But you have about 4 bosses, and I think another 4 mini-bosses that you have to fight on your way out, and then you have to fight Hades, who is crazy strong. So while you don't necessarily... I'm sure there's people out there who are skilled enough to do this whole thing without upgrades, but upgrades rarely help, because it is kind of difficult to predict where some of the attacks will land, and it's a little bit hard to tell, you know, visually, which is coming for me, where all the other characters are, you can get snuck up on a lot. And generally, it is filled with bad guys. So by, I don't know, rule of nature, something will hit you at some point. And everyone in this game can do some damage.
Ah, so it's not like you can just have like a, oh, you know, the enemy's too weak, they just do like a chip damage. So you're saying that, like, even the weakest enemy can still take out, like, a bit of your health.
Yeah, but they compensate with that by giving you upgrades, which means that at some point you will be upgraded enough to just sort of get through it all. And they have an easy mode, which I turned on without shame, because all it does is every time you die, it raises your defense by 2%.
Mm.
So you have to die 50 times before you could even reach 100% defense.
Yeah, and that's... you know, I can see how that wouldn't necessarily be super fun. But
it's just... I'm sick of going through this and being killed by skeletons. I want to hear the story.
You know, it's funny, like, with Brigador has, like, the great potential to have a really interesting story. But the game is like, no, you... Drive the party bus, dude. You gotta, Shinji, get in the party bus. And, you know, the devs are like, damn, okay, well, the next game will be more story-focused. I feel like if the people who made Hades, you know, a lot of people could, maybe they could have added, like, an accessibility mode where they made the game a lot easier, but maybe they could have just made a more story-focused game.
Well, no, I think I like how Hades... Okay, so here's where I contradict myself a bit. Hades is set up almost perfectly for its story.
Hmm.
Because Zagreus' whole quest is to break the wheel that he is currently on, where it's just respawn, go out, die, respawn again, and reach the end where he leaves Hades and finds his mother.
Yeah.
Persephone. Having this gameplay that is almost somewhat monotonous... Like this constant, oh, we're running through the same rooms and everything. It does get you into the mindset of what Zagreus would be going through, of every day being the same. But, like, every single one of my days is the same. This isn't an escape for me. The only escape is that now I'm a sexy Greek dude instead of a amorphous internet mass.
Hmm. Well, I mean, Zagreus does have really nice hair.
Dreamy eyes.
It's really interesting, you know, because I haven't played Hades. I generally speaking, prefer my roguelikes to have more ultraviolence in them.
I mean, then play Hades. It's got tons of ultraviolence.
I might actually. I think the thing that has kept me off from playing Hades is just that I feel that there has to be, you know, if I want to experience the story of a game like, you know, Enter the Gungeon, then I just have to beat it like a couple of times, and then, you know, that's it. And then every other time that I'm playing after that is just I'm playing for me, you know, at that point. But yeah, like, to get the story of Hades, I have to beat it like 14 times, and that's like, you know, well, maybe I'll get really good at it, and then it won't be so much of a slog. But I don't know.
But also, consider this, right? Every time you beat a dungeon in Hades, it becomes a lot easier to play through, because you have an idea of what to expect. And also, every time you die and go home, the characters have new lines. Like, there's more dialogue. And they're so well written that you rarely do just want to sit around and talk to them.
Mm. You know, I think what Hades does differently is that it is one of the few roguelike games where there is an evolving narrative to the roguelike story that relies on the fact that it's a roguelike. You know, FTL's story doesn't change from run to run. Like,
yeah,
you know, the moment-to-moment details might differ, but like, at the beginning you're in a random sector, at the end you're fighting the, you know, the flagship. But Hades is, I think, one of the roguelikes that is like, okay, we're going to use the fact that this is a roguelike to tell a story. And maybe that is, of course, very unique.
I mean, I remember I spent a ton of money on freeing Orpheus.
Mm-hmm.
So now he's just sitting in the throne room next to Hades, like refusing to play music because he's lost his passion or whatever. And I'm wondering if I can find his, like, love somewhere out in the world.
Eurydice, right?
And bring her back, and then maybe he'll start playing music again.
Mm. Yeah, that's you know, a super interesting thing, I think. And it definitely, you know, now that Disco Elysium and Hades are off the table, I'm really, really interested in your first game.
First, we need to hear yours.
Ah, all right, fine. You've coaxed it out of me. So, I like... Okay, Dune is coming out in some time, right? It's definitely... Dune is going to get made. So, I've always been a fan of the Dune series. I've loved that kind of science fiction ever since I was a kid. Those are some of the first books that I was, you know, really interested in reading. I remember seeing, you know, a giant sandworm on the cover of, like, Dune. It's like, whoa, this is a big mystery. I want to find out what's happening. And I think I've always kind of yearned for a story like that, but, you know, one in a video game. And this game, my top game of the year, is a game that I've played. I played it briefly. I played it and I beat it. And then I kept playing it for a while after that. And every single time I just felt more and more like excited. And, you know, when I finally, you know, got the actual ending of the game, in a way, I was kind of really moved. Right, this is the reason why the game is why this game is number one, and that is Crying Suns by the game studio Alt Shift. So,
Crying Suns like boy children, or Crying Suns like stars?
Stars, right? The Crying Suns is, I hate to say this, Callum, but it's a tactical roguelike game.
Oh my god! Oh, we're so typecast.
We are. We are completely typecast. You know, I should have just made, like, a top roguelikes of the list, you know, a top roguelikes.
Yeah, top roguelikes of 2020.
Yeah, because honestly, you know, roguelikes have really dominated this list. And honestly, when we do that episode about roguelikes, we should maybe, you know, talk about that. But so the thing about Crying Suns is it's a strategy roguelike, right? You are in command of a ship. That ship has, like, fighters and drones and like frigates and stuff like that, you know, but also weapons. And like FTL, you have to get from one sector of the galaxy to the other. But the thing is, FTL has a fairly fixed story, right? A fairly fixed narrative that, you know, really, it doesn't differ too much, you know, in terms of like what it's trying to do. And it doesn't really have like a lot of in-depth storytelling. Crying Suns is a game that is a galactic-wide story of, you know, love, betrayal, revenge, and questioning, you know, the nature of humanity. So the game starts.
Oh, just about that, huh?
It is kind of like a Dune book in a video game, and I love it to bits.
So I have not read Dune.
Have you read the Foundation series by Isaac Asimov?
No.
Okay. are you familiar with Warhammer 40K?
No. When you said Sandworm, I thought of Beetlejuice.
Oh, of course. All right, so the game starts in a mysterious facility, right? As you start working your way through the facility, like, you see, like, robots doing little things here and there. You see a pile of corpses just being, like, shoveled into, like, a mountain. And then the game stops on your pod, and it opens, and you come out, and there's a weird tentacle robot who introduces you to him. He introduces himself as Caliban. He tells you that you're Duncan. I mean, sorry, that you're Ellis Idaho. That's a reference.
What?
Yeah, you're Ellis Idaho, which is a reference to Dune, you know, Duncan Idaho. But you're the last great captain, the greatest admiral in human history, in the imperial history. And the Caliban needs your help because something has gone wrong. And, you know, you need to go out there and, you know, save the empire, right?
So at first,
at first it seems like a fairly, you know, mundane thing. The game starts off, your entire ship is, you know, fabricated in a secret facility called Gehenna, which is kind of, I think, hell, maybe?
Is this game also 2D?
Yeah, for the most part, yeah, it's two-dimensional. Although the battles are kind of isometric. They take place in like an in a map kind of scenario. Your crew are made up of clones. You're a clone of an admiral that used to exist. Here's your robot buddy. You know, you've got a full tank of N-fuel, of Neo-fuel. Time to hit it.
Good. That's Neo-fuel.
Neo-fuel is harvested from these giant space cubes.
If you want something to sound futuristic, put Neo in front of it.
Exactly. And so you come out into this galaxy and you're like, well, I'm the hero of the Empire. Everyone's got to, you know me. And then it turns out that actually, no. The first person that you find is like a horrible mutant whose skin is kind of falling off. And he's like, ha, I'm going to take your ship and kill you and all of that stuff. It's like, oh boy, this is, you know, going to be it. So the galaxy that you wake
up to... I'm imagining he says it like that. He's just like, I'm going to take your ship and stuff.
Yeah, he kind of does that, yeah. So, you know, the galaxy that you wake up to is in disarray. You know, all of the other machines, these omnis, right, that human civilization has come to depend on, like, they do all the work, they do all the stuff. They all shut down. There are no signals coming from the galaxy. The universe is kind of dark. And what follows is an epic sci-fi odyssey of you going to discover, you know, what has happened. You chase leads, like, you chase, you know, you go from sector to sector chasing leads, fighting enemies, killing, you know, mutant warlords and, like, genocidal slavers, even a weird, you know, religion that's like humanity has to suffer for the sins of technology and so on and so forth. And it's like, at every turn of the story, it's like your character tries to learn more about himself and remember, you know, who he was and why he did this. And maybe you have to even question if the civilization that you came from is worth saving at all. And I don't want to spoil the game. I absolutely think that you should play it. You know, mechanically, every battle, the game has two components, which I think are really interesting. So every battle is a ship-to-ship battle. You can shoot your guns, kind of like FTL, you know, your abilities have, you know, a charge cooldown, yeah. But you can also send out like waves of ships and fighters in to try and attack the enemy ship and defend your own ship, kind of making it a little bit like a strategy game, like an RTS. But then the game also has an away mode, right? So you have lieutenants and some of them can have like special abilities and so on and so forth. But when you get to certain ships, you can send a ground team, you know, down to the planet and then you get to dispatch a team and you watch their progress in real time as they try to navigate the environment. And maybe some of them die. Maybe they get eaten by a flesh beast. Who knows?
Hang on. let's put a pin in that real quick. Flesh what now?
Yeah. So, Callum, you know, it turns out then when robots do all the work, humans like to get freaky with the genetic modification.
Yeah.
And
okay.
With robots no longer being around to like, you know, manage the drugs, everyone is just going crazy and some of them have mutated into like these horrific, you know, monstrosities and like, yeah, you have to fight them sometimes. But the thing is, you don't actually directly do it. You just have to pick the captain. So it's like watching a Star Trek episode. Like you pick the captain and like the commandos and stuff like that, but then you don't have any direct input except whether or not they should abandon the mission. And so it's very tense. It's like a very tense moment. You're like, do I have the right composition? Sometimes, you know...
You essentially pick all the players, yeah, and then you just sit back and watch it unfold?
Yeah. The game does let you, like, oh, certain kinds of abilities will be useful for certain missions and so on and so forth. But for the most part, it is, you know, a gamble, right? Because the universe is in chaos. And yeah, that's basically the game. You have to sometimes make decisions. You know, sometimes that guy who's begging for fuel is actually, you know, just going to scam you. Sometimes the kids who are begging for help are suicide bombers who are religiously indoctrinated. It's a wild game, and
this is a really dark remake of WALL-E.
It's so good, though. You know, it's grim darkness in a way that, like, is not stupid. You know, in a way, because, like, for starters, you know, there's...
I mean, the entire Warhammer community hates you already. Let's alienate them some more.
Well, for starters, you know, like, half the crew of your ship are, like, women. Like, you've got two captains. One of them is a dude. One of them is a lady. And...
Women in my science fiction?
Yeah, you know, you can have women, you can have, you know, people of color. In fact, it's kind of funny, like, the racial boundaries of the world are, like, broken down, where you can have someone whose name is, like, multicultural. Like, you know, they can have a name like, Javier Horkenheimer, you know, because he's, like, Brazilian-German or whatever, you know?
From the New Guinea, Horkenheimer. I know of you well.
Yeah, you can, you know, you can do that. People are more based on, like, which house do you sort into? It's like the worst Harry Potter timeline, you know, rather than, like, which race are you? And that's really interesting. You know, the game has, like, really good attention to, like, technology. Like, oh, you know, there's a stock market. And when it collapsed, people started beating each other with sticks for a can of beans.
I mean, that, like, there's a quote that's, just anarchy is three meals away.
Yeah, yeah. Human civilization is like three meals away from collapsing. It is the case. You know, a lot of people are like, you know, we can only like run society for like five more years before we no longer have any technology that we can use. And it's like, yeah, it's real bad. I've got to do something. But every time you die, you know,
whoops,
your body is your consciousness is transported back into the next clone of Admiral Idaho. You get sent out with another ship, you know, to do the mission over again. And it's like, yeah, and then your snarky, which I assume would be voiced with like a British accent, your snarky robot is like, oh, are we trying to get the record for the most number of deaths in a row, sir? And you're like, shut it, robot.
Man, there are so many roguelikes that do that. Like, there's also, as soon as you walk out of the blood pit in Hades, there's a guy, like a snarky dude who's like, oh, you know, I always wondered what those bomb skeletons would do if someone just sort of stood there.
Yeah, I definitely like it. I think that interactivity and the fact that the game like evolves. So I will say this, and maybe this is the last thing I will say. Crying Suns is not a true roguelike in the sense that every run is from the beginning, because it does have kind of a concession to story, right? You can, if you want, start every, you know, campaign over from the beginning. But once you beat a chapter of the game, you can just play the game from that chapter, right? If you die, you go back to that chapter beginning. You don't have to necessarily, you know, restart all the way back from the beginning. And the game has some story justifications for this, you know, the way that warp travel works and so on and so forth. But, you know, I think that makes it easy to play the game. If you just are interested in the story, you can actually, you know, get through the story relatively easily. And you don't have to, like, invest a lot of time, because you can just go back to the, you know, chapter if you got wiped out in the sector and play it again. And every sector is, like, themed, and those themes will tell you, like, oh, you know, expect these kinds of ships, oh, expect those kinds of ships.
Yeah.
I had a lot of fun playing it. I was almost brought to tears by the end of the experience. That's why Crying Suns is my favorite game, and it is absolutely gorgeous to look at. The pixel art in this game is some of the best pixel art, I think, of all of the games that I've played this year. Now we're in the most vaunted position, Callum's number one game.
I don't know if any of you guys who are listening, guys and girls, well, I guess guys is unisex, I don't know if you're aware of this, but this isn't all that I do with my life. I also work on a website called Brutal Gamer, where I review games for a living. Back in August, I was given a game to review called Scully.
Ooh.
And I said in the opening paragraph of my review, which I have open in front of me because I can't remember my opinions, I said it currently sits as my my game of the year.
Hmm. Scully.
That was in August.
Whoa.
Things have not changed.
Wow. Okay. So what is Scully?
Scully is a 3D action platformer.
Oh my. I can't believe it's not a roguelike.
Yeah, isn't that crazy? It's not 2D, it's not isometric, and it's not a roguelike. The only reason it doesn't have like a perfect score in my head is because action platformers in 3D are inherently flawed. 2D will always be the best platforming art style because you will be able to see the platforms very easily and you don't need to turn the camera.
Yeah, and you can see your shadow and stuff like that more easily.
Yeah, because platforming is about flow.
Yeah.
And all those wasted seconds you have, like in Mirror's Edge or even Scully, rotating the camera to look at the next platform you have to jump onto breaks flow.
Yeah.
But Scully is so good.
All right. I want to know more. What is it about Scully that makes it great?
A long time ago, or possibly in the future, it's not clear. a god, an elemental deity made of rocks,
ooh,
enchants a piece of clay and sticks it into a discarded skull that washes up on his island. That births you, Scully. You are then entreated by this god, who is an incredibly cheerful person, to go and repair the family bonds he has with his siblings after their after a fight happened. I don't want to spoil anything.
Yeah.
As you do, you basically roll around these islands as the skull. It's very fast, it's a little bit slippery sometimes, and you can jump and things to get onto different platforms. But the interesting part is that you will find these mud pits, which are save points.
Mm.
As soon as you go over them, you can sink down into it and achieve a new form.
Ooh.
So the first form you get, which is the only one I'll talk about, is a giant like rock golem.
Ooh,
who is slow, but he can punch things. So he can do fighting with all the enemies, and he can also move rocks into
heavy bridges,
and break down walls and stuff. Yeah. And one of the cool aspects of it is that you can spit the skull back out.
Ooh.
So then the rock golem stands where he's supposed to stand, and it functions kind of like temporal clones. Yeah, you can climb back in.
Yeah.
So you can have several of these rock guys running around at a time, and it uses all of these gameplay mechanics in such interesting ways. There are three rock forms in total, and it makes use of all of them. They all have different abilities, and it's so hard to describe without spoiling it, but there are so many moments where you have to like jump from one form to another to perform a puzzle, or you can like skill shot, double jump with one form, and then spit the skull out, and you're on a higher ledge now. And all the characters are fun to listen to. The audio, the voice acting is good, which I'm playing another game right now where the voice acting is terrible, and I can't tell you how noticeable it is when that's the case. The music is great. The level, it looks wonderful. The levels are well designed. I just had a blast with this game.
So why Scully? You know, I mean, we've got games on your list like Disco Elysium, Hades. Why Scully in particular is number one?
Because all of those games, I couldn't forget the problems.
Hmm.
You see, when I have to review a game or even just play it, my critical mind is consistently picking up issues as I'm going along, and it hampers my enjoyment. And if I work at it, I can move past it. But Scully is one of the first games in a long time where I actively ignored the problems with it while I was playing, and I didn't even notice them.
Oh wow.
One of the big rules I have when I'm reviewing something is how many notes I take during my review process. And if I look, like I also review Death Stranding, which I had 3 pages of notes for, and Scully, I have like a page.
Wow.
Over an 18-hour gaming experience.
So that's actually pretty high praise.
I think I gave it a 93.
Wow. And, you know, it sounds kind of like a game like Knack, almost, in a way.
Yeah, but where Knack falls down is the characters. I don't think they interact well, but in Scully, the characters are charming and interesting and have drive and emotion and aren't just tropes. They get introduced as tropes, but as it goes forward, you discover more about them.
Yeah, and you know, I think another thing that maybe kind of works in its favor is Scully is a game that has, you know, a fairly interesting premise that sounds not just like, you know, Crying Suns is a game that it wears its influence. It wears like Dune and Foundation and all of that stuff on its sleeve. And it's like, I'm going to tell a story that's this kind of story. Whereas if I think about Scully, I'm like, I don't really, you know, I can't really draw a through line, you know, to some other games, you know, necessarily in terms of like story elements. It's just like, oh, I'm a skull. I have to solve like a familial. It sounds more like a Greek tragedy, you know, than.
Yeah. Maybe that's what attracted me to it.
Okay.
It's just fun. It's just fun.
Unfortunately, a lot of the problems about having like a tier list like this is that I really want people to play these games. So I can't really, like, I could talk about Crying Suns for a long time, but I don't want to spoil it, you know, at least not in this sense. And I feel like Scully is kind of the same way. One of the things about roguelikes, I guess, which makes them easy to talk about, is you can talk a lot about the stuff without spoiling anything, because a lot of it is mechanical and not so much story-based. But yeah, I think that's a tier list.
But you know what, Emilio?
Yeah.
We do have a Patreon.
Yeah.
As well as very many social links that people can see. So we might end up releasing this tier list on those links.
Ooh, indeed we will. Indeed
and then we will. You can buy the games we recommend to you.
We don't get any of the kickbacks.
We are not supported by these companies at all. But if they want to...
Look, Callum, all I'm saying is if Subset Games were like, hey, we heard you were talking, you know, good about our game. Do you want to, you know, take a sponsorship to try out their next game? I would, you know.
I'm holding my breath until Supergiant Games gives us a deal.
or Devolver Digital. All right. If that's everything, we can end the episode.
No, I don't think that's everything. I mentioned earlier that this is only one facet of my life. And while our videos may be free, food is not.
Correct.
So if you would like to support us, please check out our Patreon. We'll have a link below to it. You can get in for as little as $1 a month and achieve bonuses like a video a couple of days early, where other filthy peasants would have to wait a full month. But if you would like to also support me in my endeavors, then please check out Brutal Gamer, which is the site that I work at. We're going to post one of my review links in the comments down below. And if you do, Google Ads might finally give us enough money to start paying each other.
Yeah, that would be awesome, wouldn't it?
Oh, I wish. But Google Ads is so weird about how they do things. It's so, like, bureaucratic.
It is, I think, designed very deliberately to favor particular kinds of people and not other kinds of people, if you get my drift.
Absolutely. So feel free to check out the links below where we'll be posting some of our other things. New videos will be coming just about, I think, next year.
Yeah, we are going to start next year with a schedule which we will hopefully be able to keep to. I have lots of new special episodes in the works. We've got, you know, the potential to bring on loads of new guests, you know, lots of interesting people, some faces from the left, some faces from, you know, just cool places. And I will hopefully be producing more content for the channel soon. And we hope that you will join us in this crazy thing called making a podcast together.
And please check out the social links, because even though you don't have the voting power that our patrons have, sorry about that, capitalism is a bitch, you will be able to influence some of our decisions when we post, like, future video ideas and ideas for new series that we might be doing. And we've been tooling around with a lot of interesting stuff, but we would like to hear your input on whether that's what you'd like to see.
Yeah, we do have some democracy, but unfortunately you kind of have to pay for it.
It's a real system.
All right, everyone. I think we can call it. Have a good 2020, what remains of it.
Happy holidays and Merry New Year.
Yeah. All right. Bye, everyone.
Ciao.